From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, coming to you from 1540 WADK Newport. I'll talk on all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business, along with the business of politics and sports. Bringing recovery from alcohol and drug abuse into the open, the role of recovery coaches in maintaining sobriety. We hear from someone who's been through recovery, now on a mission as a recovery coach to help others, bring awareness, help remove the stigma associated with substance abuse. Ford Gardner is a recovery coach professional certified by CCAR. That's the Connecticut Community for Addiction Recovery. Been in recovery for 3 years from alcohol use disorder. He's been a Darien resident since 1979, the same year I moved to Greenwich. And we've been lifelong friends, as our parents were too, growing up in Lake Forest, Illinois, out in the Midwest. Approached me recently about helping get his story to the public so they can help people who need help get help. Welcome, Ford.
Hey, good to be here.
Good to see you, my man. Kind of a tough road you've been on, yeah, but you're giving back now?
I'm doing my best to pay it forward now. Yeah, it has been a tough road. As you may recall, our parents and their peers were all the greatest generation. And alcohol was, you know, part of the deal there all the time. So I just figured that lifestyle was normal. And there wasn't really anybody to talk to if there was anything on anybody's mind back then. So I just, you know, the way everybody took care of whatever anxiety they had or fear or anything else, or anger or even happiness. The way they took care of that, the way they dealt with that was the bottle.
You started drinking at 15 and didn't give up till 60, you told me.
Correct. Well, actually, the first time I ended up leaning over the porcelain throne was when I was 13.
Oh.
But, yeah, 15 was when it really started.
And both your parents were alcoholics?
My dad was unquestionably a card-carrying alcoholic. My mom, I think by definition, yeah.
Really? I didn't know that. I knew both of his parents.
So I think that I was part of the picture, I think, is that I was doomed I think I came out of the womb with a drink in my hand. But, that is part of the deal is
genetic as well as cultural.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a genetic component to it. And, I've got shake either one of my family trees, my father, my side, my mom's side, and, all kinds of bottles fall out.
I hate to say it, that's not unusual in Lake Forest. And my mother's side of the family, generation after generation, and nobody talks about it. That's the problem. So there's no generational knowledge, although it has gotten better in each generation. Did your dad know he was an alcoholic? Did he deal with it?
He got sober when he was about 67 or 8.
So you're ahead of him.
So I'm ahead of him, yeah. And
did he do that by himself? And
he did that only because the guys at the golf club called up my mom and told her that he was his behavior was getting embarrassing.
Really?
Yeah. So.
So your mom kicked his butt?
He actually didn't do it for himself, which did not please my mother. He did it so he would stop embarrassing his friends at the golf club.
Great. And by the way, you should say his family is famous for U.S. amateur golf, right?
My grandfather, Robert A. Gardner, won the amateur in 1909 and then again in 1915. And he was the youngest amateur winner until Tiger came along.
How about that? And that's also inherited because all you guys are good.
That's another family disease.
I didn't pick that up, by the way. My family, there's good golfers too. But I started at 60 again, which is, you gave up drinking at 60. I took up golf at 60. I don't know.
Well, I was a drinker with a golfing problem.
And you were an excellent golfer. So let's start to get underneath this underneath the hood for a sec. In the notes you sent me, you said there was some traumatic event at school at age 16 that was a driver to this. What was that?
Some people might have noticed over the last, I'd say probably 3-4 years, the boarding school environment, the boarding school, thing is, it's like a miniature version of the Catholic Church now. And, one after another school is coming to the forefront after trying to shove everything under the rug for decades. And, I went to a school in Rhode Island, and was subject of abuse by my English teacher.
Really?
When I was 16, and I had been kind of a fearful kid anyway. I sort of grew up sort of in a what if this happens, what if that happens, what if this doesn't happen, what if that doesn't happen,
a worry
kind of thing. And this just sort of, it set me on a, it was a driver. It was not the cause. But, you know, from that point on, there was very little I cared about. I didn't think that I was worth anything at that point.
Did you ever report this or?
No.
So you didn't know how to handle it.
In 1971, this was not something that anybody talked about in polite circles. And, you know, the headmaster and his wife were like second parents to me. I adored them. Mm-hmm. But I could not go to them. And I couldn't tell my classmates. And so
Your parents, I assume.
No chance. And so I buried it and carried it.
Wow.
And I actually had, hard as it may be to believe, I hadn't even thought about it for over four decades until I got a call from an attorney to talk about another faculty member at the same school, and all of a sudden this stuff came bubbling up. And that,
so you might even have buried it.
I totally buried it. I buried it and under, you know, 3 feet of concrete. Would have taken C4 to get it out.
Wow.
But then it busted through the steel door, and that was the beginning. That was really the beginning of the end. That was August of 2015.
Wow.
And I went into the hospital on December 1st, 2015 with pancreatitis, and I ended up spending 2 months there because I went into the DTs, and they put me in a coma for a month. So... and that was just the beginning. And then the end of that 2 months, my wife said, "You're not going home." I said, "Huh?" She said, "You're going to rehab." And finally, in the first lucid moment I'd had in quite some time, I said, "Okay, enough's enough." You know.
And your body was breaking down, right? You'd been sick.
My body was completely breaking down. I was in the hospital 8 times. I was in the hospital 8 times in 14 months. I got pneumonia 7 times. And I had something called parainfluenza, which I don't really know what that is, but all I know is that they were gowned and masked when they came into the room. So I was pretty much on lockdown for that week. I also had 2 procedures done on my throat, which is why I sound like this. I lost a little bit of a vocal cord. Those are 2 additional hospitalizations, so it was really 10 times in the hospital in 16 months. But the bottom line was my immune system was flatline, gone.
How did you keep your morale?
At what point?
I mean, you've been in the hospital 10 times in 16 months. How are you even, you know, mentally able to function?
Because I knew, went from the first hospitalization, which was 2 months. I then went to Silver Hill in New Canaan for 6 weeks, and they do a wonderful job there. And at that point, I had hope that since I've been spared somehow, you know, I was going to be able to, you know, to hopefully live a good life. Obviously, it's a very long process.
Talk about a little bit about rehab. What's it like and everything?
Well, I was, Silver Hill isn't exactly, you know, I mean,
one of the best, right?
It's really one of the prominent ones in the country. And it's interesting that in all those years, I was so oblivious to the world outside me. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I mean, I was a raving alcoholic. I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and I certainly didn't know anything about recovery. So,
and you had no idea you were an alcoholic.
If somebody really pointed it out to me, I would have said, "Oh yeah," but for whatever reason, nobody ever did. I mean, my father never said anything because I'm sure he figured, "Well, who am I to talk?" You know. And I used to amuse my mother when I would come home and run into every piece of furniture in the house. You know, my sisters just sort of rolled their eyes and said, you know, little brother, you know, what a dummy. So it just never, and my wife, I've been married 30 years come June, and for some reason, neither she nor either of our kids ever just said, hey, you're an idiot. So I really didn't know.
Amazing story. Listen to Business Talk with Jim Campbell over the Business Talk Radio Network, 350 stations around the country. Go to businesstalkradio.com. Find the station closest to you. Listen over the internet. We'll talk about Ford's mission in segment two.
Hi, I'm Robert Reese, and if you'd like to learn from the top CEOs in America, join me weekday afternoons at 5 p.m. for the Best of the CEO Forum on 1540 AM WADK, Newport, Rhode Island.
We're back with Darien resident Ford Gardner. He's now a recovery coach after getting over alcohol abuse, or you never really get over it, I realize.
No, you don't.
We'll talk about that for a sec. When you get the end, and as you said, you were kind of in denial about it, what were you drinking all the time? Was this just a nighttime thing? How did it affect you?
Other than on vacation, I was really not a day drinker. But on vacation, you know, and on the weekends, you know, after before golf, during golf, after golf. You know,
I like it. Affect your game either, eh?
Well, after a while, it really did. So
you're mainly drinking at night.
It was mainly at night, and I finally, and this is a very typical progression, is that one's world starts to get very, very small. I was in a bar after work with a bunch of people that didn't care about me, and frankly, I didn't care about them. And I just said, well, this is a waste of money. So I would buy the liquor and, you know, I'd buy the vodka and take it home and drink it at home. And I would be alone. I mean, I would be alone in a room of 50 people. And I was lonely and alone. And a lot of it is just, you know, all these things, the way I reacted to everything, unlike my father, was a very mellow drinker. I had a, you know, not an overly short fuse, and I wasn't mean, nasty, but I had a very real lack of patience with my family members, and I would just react to things. And I looking back on it now, because I've been in therapy now for a while, and I look back on it now, and I realize that, you know, I could never accept my own imperfection. And so once this thing happened at school, I mean, you know, obviously none of us is ever going to be perfect, but I was never even going to be worth it as far as I was concerned.
Have you forgiven yourself now?
I'm still working on that. It's been 3 years now. It is a process. And, you know, if I hear anybody say I'm recovered, as in recovered ED, I don't buy it.
You know, it's interesting because I just happened to watch, and mixes in with your prep school experience, the thing on Michael Jackson leaving Neverland. And they asked the two guys who were in there, they said, have you forgiven yourself? And one guy said, I have. The other guy said, just what you said, I'm working on it.
Yeah.
And you see the torment and you know, that these poor kids are under. How did your wife and kids survive this, or how'd they deal with you?
Well, before I told them what had happened, which gave them a little bit of context, the kids just avoided me. I coached my son all the way up until he was 15, Babe Ruth baseball. But, you know, that was during the day, and I could always answer the bell in the morning. Mm-hmm. My relationship with my daughter was a little bit more volatile, and you know, at one point she actually moved out of the house because she just didn't want to be around me. And, you know, I would say stuff that was just, you know, you think about, you know, how in the world could I have possibly said that? But that's, you know, that's what happens. And, you know, then I told, as I said, I hadn't told anybody, my sisters, my kids, my wife. I hadn't told anybody what had happened. So it did give them a little bit of context. But, you know, before that, my wife, I was just drinking nips, you know, airline bottles. And, you know, I thought that was economical, you know, in good alcoholic thinking. It was economical because they were only...
You were being productive.
It's only 99 cents a piece instead of $6 for a drink. And also...
That is good thinking.
And I also thought it was portion control, which is really kind of funny because it's portion control if you don't drink 10 of them. But I'd drink a few of them and then take a bunch of them home and drink them. And there were nights when I just got up and I just told my wife, I got to go get some more. And I'd go get some more. And she would just sort of sigh and roll her eyes. Yeah. And she
didn't give up on you?
No. Her dad was an alcoholic. And so I think she sort of got it. But I don't think she really knew what to do. So it just went on. It just went on like that. And then... the hospitalization I referred to as my third one for alcohol-related.
But you had not been to rehab.
I had not been to rehab. I hadn't even thought about rehab. I knew nothing about recovery. And it was just an amazing education going to Silver Hill because, they taught me all kinds of things about, I was able to examine myself. But, you know, I learned about alcoholism itself and addiction and what goes into that. And then what I think about what I did to my frontal lobe when I was a teenager. And it's actually probably a miracle that I can even put together, a coherent sentence. But, and my mom drank bourbon, whiskey, and smoked cigarettes through 3 pregnancies because that's what they did in the 50s.
I didn't even remember she smoked, yeah.
So, she ended up, she finally quit. My father quit drinking, he never could quit smoking. Nicotine is probably harder than heroin. I've been told by former crack addicts that they had a harder time quitting smoking than they did quitting crack.
Now, you've come out of rehab. How are you? You don't have a desire to drink anymore? You go to AA meetings all the time? How do you handle it?
I really don't have a desire to drink anymore. For me, and this is something I want to emphasize, I do follow a 12-step program of recovery. Mm-hmm. That's what is working for me. But I do want to emphasize that there are many, many pathways to recovery, and that's part of the wonderful training that I've gotten as a recovery coach of knowing what these other pathways are, because 12-step doesn't work for everybody. It does work for me. I go to a meeting every day that I
can. Do you really? Yeah. And is that in New Canaan? Or
I go in New Canaan 6 days a week, and then New Canaan, there's a meeting at Silver Hill on the weekends I go to. So, yeah, it's all up in New Canaan. If I can make 7 days a week, I make 7 days a week. But I'm still... I'm still getting an infusion of antibodies once a month. It's like 5 hours in the chair.
That is like a vitamins kind of thing?
Continue to build up my immune system.
Wow. And your health obviously much better? You're not...
It's better, but the 45-plus years of smoking cigarettes...
So you smoked for 45 years?
More than that, really. But, that's for... out loud, I should say, for 45 years, and I now have a little bit of emphysema from that. So, I wouldn't call my health great, but it's certainly way better than it was.
Do you exercise now?
I try. I don't get very far before I get winded, and I need to try to figure out how I'm going to, build that up. But now that it's getting warmer, I know I can get out and walk more, but... I'm lazy as hell, so the pulmonologist says go to the mall and just walk the mall
All right, we're going to talk recovery coaching when we get back with Ford. And we're back. Ford Gardner is now a sobriety recovery coach, himself a recovering alcoholic. And we were talking, not only does he want to pay it forward, but he really knows he's lucky to be around, because with 10 hospitalizations in 16 months, and saying any one of them might have killed him, and he's still going strong. Tell us what a recovery coach is and what your mission is.
Well, the recovery coaching is something that actually existed back before, but then kind of died away because the MO of the government went from, we will try to help you, to we're going to put you in jail. So that's kind of where that's where all the money was spent, was in building up the whole jail system. And you know, the care of the, you know, what's available for mental health care in this country is just, it's awful. I don't know what the answer is, but what I'm hoping to do, the CCAR, Connecticut Community for Addiction Recovery, among other things, has started putting people in emergency rooms over the last 2 years. And of the people that have had contact with a recovery coach, 93% of them have sought treatment above and beyond the ER. And that's unbelievable.
Sounds like the whole game, right?
And, so I may end up doing that. And it's also just, you know, working with individuals. And it's not working with, you know, a whole room full at the same time and having to compile notes on every single one of them. And, it's not a state. It's not. The government will at some point step in, because we're trying to get insurance companies to say that we can accept insurance. But it's, for me, I have my master's in education. I was always a teacher. I was always a coach. I was always a mentor. That's just the way I was wired. Mm-hmm. I mean, I first started coaching when I was 15. I started teaching junior golf clinics when I was 15 years old. And I coached for 32 years, 5 different teams. And my athletic past, I don't look like an athlete anymore, that's for sure. But it has helped me tremendously in this process, because there's just some things you understand about. For one thing, working with other people, which is not something that one tends when one is in the throes of the disease, one tends to not ask for help. It just is antithetical to, they don't want help. They just want to disappear. They don't want, I mean, I'll speak for myself. I didn't want to be me. I didn't like me. I didn't think I was worth a damn. So I was happier, putting my brain kind of somewhere else, and so I didn't have to be me. And but what I didn't realize was the problem. None of the problems went away. Yeah. You know, they go away for a little while, but then you come out of it, and the problems are still there. So what I'm trying to, what I'm hoping to do is use my ability as a coach and a teacher. To first of all, instill hope. When I got to Silver Hill, I just didn't know. You know, I didn't know. And a lot of people, who are newly in recovery, and they're really devoid of hope. They just don't think that they're ever going to be able to do it. There's another way of living, which I was utterly unaware of. I never realized that there was another way of living. Mm-hmm. Sober living. What's sober living?
Yes.
I mean, you know, when I was a kid, the way you had fun at a party was, you know, to completely,
and the way you put yourself, manage stress, right?
Put yourself in the clouds, and that. But then, and it's anxiety. It's most of it is. It's a lot of it is. I won't say most of it. A lot of it is very much fear based. I was afraid of not getting something I wanted. I was afraid of losing whatever I had. These are all things that are really very common.
How'd you get your hope back?
I got my hope back as soon as I had spent a couple of weeks in the inpatient in the
Silver
in
Hill.
At Silver Hill in the transitional housing, transitional residential housing. That I actually laughed while I was there for the first time since I could remember.
Really?
I mean, a real belly laugh. Because these people get it. And then I walked into the meeting that I go to in New Canaan, and there was 120 people in there. And it didn't scare me at all. I said to myself for the first time, since age 15, I'm not alone anymore. And that's the whole thing that really helps give hope, is that we realize that we're not unique. My story isn't any different from anybody else's.
So you'd felt you were alone for like 40 years.
I felt like I was totally alone, and I just figured that you know, this is my life. This is how I'm going to live, and this is how I'm going to die, and I don't know how long I'm going to live. Now I'm excited about I'm genuinely excited, you know, about, you know, what I can do in the, you know, whatever time I got left on this earth.
And you're enjoying working with folks now?
Well, I've always liked working with people.
Yeah.
I owned a retail store. It was a little store, and it was one of those places where it was always, you know, people came and they were happy to be there because they got treated really well. And I was a school teacher forever. I mean, I loved working with the kids and coaching the kids. And I mean, you know, I've always been very much a people person. Unfortunately, a lot of my professional life, I had to try to sell stuff that I didn't know if people needed, and I wasn't very good at that. But
now you're selling something you believe in.
Now, you know, every job is a sales job, but now what I'm trying to do is sell hope and sell a pathway to a better way of living and a better way of coping with, you know, instead of reacting to negative things in my life, I'm now able to see them as challenges, however small or however big, and respond to them. And react and respond are two very different things. In reacting, I used to say, this really made me angry, and I got to go have a drink because I'm really unhappy with it. Now I see it as a challenge, you know, and I need to deal with it in a constructive way, in a positive way. So I don't feel as though I have to go, you know, drink at it.
What do you think about Darien, Greenwich, places like that?
I'm glad you asked that. You know, for a long, long time, I mean, well, alcohol use goes back, like at least 8,000 years. I mean, man has always figured that, you know, hey, this is great. You know, I feel better, whatever it was.
Whatever the substance.
But the stereotypical drunk used to be, you know, the guy in the raincoat underneath the overpass with the paper bag, you know, that kind of thing. And one of the things that I feel, and that we as a recovery community feel, is really important, is to put a face on recovery, put a face on addiction and alcoholism, and put a face on recovery, because, you know, we're not bums, we're good people, but places like Lower Fairfield County have a much, much, much bigger problem than they will typically admit.
Is the stigma start going away?
The stigma is lessening, although, you know, in some professions it's a tough go, you know, if you go away to rehab. Although, you know, I know a guy that he worked on Wall Street, and his boss, when he told his boss he was going to go to rehab, and he said, well, I'm afraid you're going to fire me. And his boss said, if you don't go, I'm going to fire you.
Yeah.
You know, so it is lessening, but the education has to be there, and people have to get out of the whole, you know, denial. No, you know, I don't have a problem. You know, and which, you know, I was in denial forever. I mean, I just didn't even think about it. A lot of people get told that they have a problem and they deny they have a problem.
Yeah. It's a disease of denial.
It is.
It's a family denial, you know, too.
It's a disease of the mind. It's like an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind.
Listen to Business Talk with Jim Campbell. We'll be back with our final national segment with Ford Gardner. Stay with us. All right, we're back for our final segment with Ford. And you also were telling me that, you know, that we've not only have this lower Fairfield County, but obviously there's a lot of partying and stuff amongst high school kids. And what's your thought on the high school range and going up the young adults?
This area is a real high-stress area for the most part. I mean, there are a lot of people making a lot of money and a lot of kids who... either, you know, his parents either aren't paying attention or kids who feel pressure to live up to a set of standards that, you know, they may not even be able to attain. And that results in a lot of stress. And you know, the studies have shown the stress level of kids from age 16 all the way up to like through, you know, 28 or so has skyrocketed. And suicide rates have jumped way up, and also between the opioids, which everybody's been hearing about, and the alcohol, which not as many people hear about. If you add up the two numbers, I mean, each of those is causing in excess of 80,000 deaths a year in the United States of America. So in doing the math, that's like 430, 440 people every single day.
Mind-boggling.
So that's like two airplanes. If one airplane crashes, it's going to be national news for like, you know, a week.
Yeah.
There's like two airplanes crashing every single day. It gives me great hope when I see the kids sort of starting to figure out that, you know, maybe there's a different way, you know, that they don't have to just get absolutely rip-roaring drunk or high to have fun. I know in New Canaan, they have something called the Ram Council, and there's over 100 kids that have signed a pledge to be sober. And CCAR had, Liberation Programs, which is in Norwalk, Stamford.
We've had them on here, by the way.
They do
a lot of good work.
They have an office at Greenwich High. You know, so there's more conversation, and there's also more, you know, there's more available in terms of, you know, just people to speak with. I mean, I go to a therapist every week. Yeah, I mean, when you and I were kids, some of the wealthy women had shrinks, but they would never admit it.
No,
it just wasn't something that was talked about. Now, you know, mental health is something that's starting to come into people's consciousness. That, you know, and the world is crazy right now. I mean, face it. I mean, I don't watch the news anymore.
No,
I just don't. You know, it's nuts. And I mean, I don't care what side of the whole argument you're on. It's nuts. And I just don't worry about it. I can't do anything about it. And it's one of the things that I've learned.
What do you think about the fentanyl and Oxycontin opioid problem? And is there a lot of mix with alcohol on that?
Well, the fentanyl is bad enough. If you mix alcohol with it, you're pretty much gone.
I was going to say, yeah.
But the fentanyl will kill you. I mean, I know two people that died directly from fentanyl because they were taking a street drug.
It's like 100 times
Xanax.
Yeah.
But it was a fake, you know, it was fake Xanax made in Mexico or made in China, and it was full of fentanyl.
Yeah.
And it killed them.
It's like 100 times stronger.
It kills your breathing. It's 100 times more powerful than morphine. The United States of America comprises a little less than 4% of the world's population, okay? The United States of America consumes 80% of all of the drugs, legal and illicit, produced in the world every year. And a lot of these problems are first world problems. You know, none of the kids that I know have ever had to eat out of a dumpster like they're doing, you know, in Venezuela or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's just pressure. It's just our culture now has gotten, you know, I mean, for one, it's fractured, and that causes tension and causes stress. But economically, there's stresses economically. I mean, this and that and the other. I mean, I know before I went into the hospital, you know, I went through all that. My alcoholic thinking managed to lose our house. We filed Chapter 7, you know, the whole bit. But you know what? I'm happy to talk about it because a lot of people strongly protect their anonymity, which I respect 100%. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter to me because I want people to realize, I want people to look at me and they say, you don't look like a drunk or, you know, whatever.
As we get down to the end, how do you feel about where you are now and what your mission in life is?
I feel great about what I am, where I am right now. And I also feel that having been spared by a power greater than myself, I've got no business being alive, given what I've done behind the wheel of a car. But having been spared, I came to realize while I was at Silver Hill and then, you know, as I started my post-rehab recovery, I came to realize that, you know, I actually have a purpose in life. And this is my purpose, is to help. I've always been a helper. But this is a life and death kind of thing. And if I can, you know, if I can help anybody, I love it.
Not much more you can do but dedicate your life to that, which means, how do they get in touch with you?
Anybody can find me on LinkedIn.com. It's Ford like the car, Gardner, Gardner. You can find me on Facebook, but there's not going to be much useful there, puppies and such.
Your email address?
My email address is ford.gardner@gmail.com, and I'm happy to answer any questions and try to help anybody in any way I can. My job is, how can I help you with your recovery?
And really what you're saying is ask for help. And there are people there
absolutely
that will answer.
Ask for help.
The hardest thing, ask for help.
Don't go it alone. Do not go it alone. I tried it, and it was a miserable experience.
Well, we're honored that you're sharing it with us, and it really is a great story. We should say for the national audience, Lower Fairfield County is in Connecticut. But obviously any affluent area in the country and any area right now in the country is affected.
Well, any area. I mean, you look at the places out in the Midwest where the fentanyl is just destroying whole communities. This disease does not see color. It does not see age. It does not see socioeconomics. It'll take us all.
Thanks to Ford Gardner. Thanks for coming in. And continued good luck and all the good work you're doing. This has been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Thanks to Ford Gardner. Thanks to our national audience for listening.